Good evening.
Good evening.
Some of you already know that this talk tonight is not original. It's a repeat. And that's not usual Zen practice. Each talk should be spontaneous and original. But there's a reason for what we're going to do tonight. Have any of you, how many of you have heard about singularity? Okay, just a few. Okay, some people do. The Singularity University. Well, if you want to know about singularity, you have to go look it up on the internet because it's too much to explain. But let me give you a little background. Singularity University is now in session, a 10-week session, at their campus at NASA, Ames Air Force Base. And the absolutely smartest people in the world, young people, are coming together to create projects, startups, that will address humanity's greatest problems, big global problems. And they want to do this using the latest technology, including artificial intelligence and nanotechnology and robotics, all the leading edge technologies, what they call exponential technologies, because they're going like that. Older technologies just went along at a nice pace, but these technologies are really taking off. So, they're in session, coming up with projects that when they go back home, they will try to implement startups. And there are about 90 students from about 40 different countries. And I think 3,000 applied, and they accepted 90. So, anyway, it turns out they're interested in meditation, mindfulness. So I was asked to talk to them about the relationship between Zen practice and technology. And when I first heard that invitation, no. But I said, well, let's see what we can learn. So I did create this talk, and I will start in just a minute. I spoke there 3 weeks ago. And went back a week later just to hear one of their speakers. We were invited to dinner and speaker, and the people who were in my class, heard my talk, all came over and said, well, we really needed to hear that. That was really good. And all the women were hugging me, you know. And I told my wife, I'm doing nothing. The point is, they seem very enthusiastic about this whole idea of bringing meditation into their work. And so Teresa said, you have to give that talk at Canada. So this is what I said. Oh, excuse me. So now make believe you're the class. So when it was suggested that I speak to you about the relationship between Zen and technology, you know, I hadn't any idea what that might look like. But I thought, it's a good idea, and the time is right. Because more and more people in Silicon Valley are moving towards Zen practice, exploring it, asking questions about it, considering it in their own life. And I've spent all my adult life in these two areas, Zen practice and technology, and so today I wanted to share with you what I've learned about that relationship. My introduction to technology was started when I began working as an engineer, electrical engineer at IBM in San Jose in 1956. Now, technology in those days was not artificial intelligence or robotics. It was punch card, tape drives, vacuum tubes, and slide rules. Do any of you own a slide rule? Okay. My wife says I should take mine to Antiques Roadshow. My life at that time was ideal, absolutely perfect. I was living the American dream of the mid-20th century. I was living in Santa Clara Valley before it became Silicon Valley, when it was still known as the Valley of Heart's Delight. Farms and orchards everywhere, very few crowded freeways. Commutes were, you wouldn't even think about it. I had a good job. I had a lovely wife, I had a family. What could I say? I could get up to San Francisco anytime I wanted to. I could go to the ocean anytime I wanted to. Couldn't be better than that. And as part of the American dream in the 1950s, I felt useful. I felt like I was adding value. I was helping my society, and I was part of progress. But after about 5 years on the job, I felt a shift in my perspective. I had a sense that there is something greater, something more, something larger than my role in society and my usual ideas of success. In other words, I had the feeling that life had another dimension, one that was not intellectual, not functional or logical, and it had no economic value. Another dimension. I had this, you know, a tiny glimpse or a sense of this mostly unseen dimension of life, but that glimpse was enough to give me a very, very strong feeling about it, and I felt compelled to explore that dimension. So I adjusted my ideal life. In 1966 is when I started Zen practice. Quite seriously, right from the beginning, very seriously. And I discovered pretty quickly that Zen does bring together the spiritual and the everyday dimensions that belong to each of us. And that the practice brings balance and and cohesion in busy lives. And that's important. That's a big deal. As you know, I discovered that Zen practice emphasizes living authentically, according to the inherent truth of things, which is beyond appearances. In other words, Zen emphasizes no BS. No BSing yourself and no BSing others. And in Buddhism, that's called no delusion. I have a question for you, but before I ask the question, I want to do a class exercise. So give me just a moment. So here's a stick of incense and a container of ash. So like we do here in the Zendo or at home, we offer incense. This stick of incense is straight.
No, it's not straight.
What?
It is not straight.
This stick of incense is, from my point of view, this stick of incense is straight.
No.
Well, let's have a vote. How many of you agree with me that this incense is straight? How many of you agree with Teresa that the incense is not straight? Well, all of you are wrong. You're dead wrong. This is, oh, wait a minute. Oh, I see. If I shift my point of view, I can see the incense is not straight. So my question for you is, what is it that gets in the way of human beings seeing the truth of things, based on this little demonstration? What is it that gets in the way? Yes, please.
It's your bias, your reference, you know, depending on how you're looking at, based on either preconditioning or some expectation.
Well, that's too...
some expectation, some bias based on reference, you know, frame of reference.
Yeah, habits.
Okay, habits. Anything else?
Education.
Your point of view.
Point of view.
Your own desires.
Yes. What characteristics was I exhibiting when I insisted that that was fake?
Stubbornness.
What else?
Ego.
Self-righteousness. That covers it. Of course. Ego, stubbornness, not being willing to shift point of view. What I discovered about Zen practice was that it softens that stubbornness and it dissolves that ego and brings you a ready mind and an unbiased mind and a willingness to consider things from different points of view. So then I asked the class, what has this to do with technology? What has this to do with artificial intelligence? What has this demonstration have to do with your work? So we left that as an unanswered question. Meditation or mindfulness is one aspect of Zen and of Buddhist practice. meditation existed thousands of years ago before Buddha's time. But Buddhism took mindfulness and meditation to a new level. So many of you probably know this, the legend of Buddha, his story, but let me go over it quickly. He was born into a royal family into a small kingdom in northern India. He was the prince and he would one day inherit the kingdom. And everybody loved this young man. He was handsome, he was kind, he was had a great sense of humor, he was very skilled, he could do things. Everybody liked him as a person. But when he became a young, when he was a young man, not quite 20, he one day got turned off by what he saw were the excesses of his royal life. He felt it was, that's not all there is. So in his 20s, in his early 20s, he left the palace, he had to sneak out. He wanted to see what's beyond the walls of this palace. And he went into the towns and he saw ordinary people for the first time. And if you know the story of Buddha, you know that he discovered, he saw sickness, old age, death, and suffering. He saw how people suffered. And his experience touched him very deeply. And he made a vow. He committed himself to put an end to all suffering. Big. But he made that kind of vow. And the people at Singularity have committed themselves to addressing very big problems as well. So that kind of motivation is not unique. Anyway, the young man, he left the palace and he became a wanderer, a hermit, a homeless person. And he studied spiritual practice with the most famous yogic teachers of his day. And each one had a little different, slightly different meditation technique and a slightly different ascetic practice where they did something with their body. And he studied with six of them, a year each, and after 6 years, he was unsatisfied. So he went off on his own. Mm-hmm. And he was living a very ascetic life, eating very little and almost died from starvation. But he recovered and devoted himself to his meditation practice. And he made a big discovery that became the foundation of Buddhism, and the discovery was that suffering comes from greed and from our desires, as well as from the ignorance of our true nature, the ignorance of the real nature of things of the world and of everyday life. This was his discovery. And he also understood that ending suffering is not a matter of finding the best technique. There's a lot of techniques out there these days. It's not a matter of finding which is the best. How to end suffering begins with having an unbiased understanding of the world and of life. This was his discovery. In my early days of Zen practice around here in the 60s, I would go to San Francisco Zen Center for retreats. And those for one-day retreats. And those are usually a challenge because some discomfort arises, some boredom arises, distractions keep coming, you want to go home. That's okay, and you learn how to deal with that, and you do the retreats. you learn how to respond to those distractions. On one of those occasions, I went to San Francisco and took my seat on my cushion, and from the very beginning, I had none of those distractions. Discomfort was not a problem. Boredom was not a problem. The various sounds of the streets, of the noises in the street, the pigeons that were cooing on the balcony, nothing was a problem. Everything was just joyful and peaceful. For the entire day, I felt like I was floating. It was some discomfort, but it just wasn't anything. And I thought, this is it. This is it. I've arrived. This is bliss. So when the retreat was over, I got in my car to go home. And I lost it. I got into traffic on the Bayshore. Pretty crowded. People were cutting in and out and speeding up and coming in off the... And I got angry and irritated and impatient. And I realized when I got home that despite that lovely day on the cushion in San Francisco, where my mind was like that, it had not eliminated the source of my emotions. It had not eliminated the source of my reactivity to things. And I realized what had been happening was I had been using meditation as a technique, as a commodity. You know, I'll do it when it's convenient. I'll do it when I feel a little stressed. Like something you pick up and then put down. I was using meditation and Zen practice as a personal technique. And I realized I needed to put some spine into my practice. I needed to carry that mind of meditation into all the activities of my life and not just simply leave it there on the cushion. You know, when you have negative things come up like that, it gets your attention. When television first came on the market in the 1950s, those of us who were around then, we fell in love with this thing, you know. This box that showed us these gray, black and white pictures that fuzzy and they did this and we'd roll over. We love it. Television. It was, for its time, it was a great piece of technology and we liked it. General Electric sponsored a program, and one of the slogan in their ad was, "Progress is our most important product." And when I heard that, I said, that's pretty clever. That sure works for General Electric. That's a good slogan for them, and it sort of talks about our society. That's what we've been doing in the U.S. since the Industrial Revolution. Progress, progress. That's our product. And the progress means, of course, making life better in various material ways. More comfort and more leisure, more labor-saving devices. More entertainment, better health, safer living conditions, as well as progress gave us something else, and that is the opportunities for creativity, for learning, and for making discoveries, which is what we do as human beings. This is what science is all about. This is what the modern world is all about, making new discoveries. And to have progress, you have to have a technology that improves every few years. An advancing technology. And in the 20th century, technologies improved the standard of living for most of humanity. Imagine what things were like at the beginning of the 20th century around the globe and what the world was like at the end of the 20th century, and you'll see tremendous progress in standard of living. But something else was going on, and that was the unwise use of technology creating problems. And let me give you an example of what could have been an unwise use of technology. The PBS television station has a series they call American Experience. And in April, this past April, they did a documentary on something called Command and Control. And that was taken from a book, Command and Control, written by an investigative journalist. His name was Eric Schlosser. The book was a bestseller. So the PBS program, American Experience, dramatized an accident with a Titan nuclear missile in Arkansas in 1980. There was an accident, a fire broke out, one man got killed, there was an explosion, the nuclear warhead was thrown out, landed in a ditch. And so that was fascinating to watch. But towards the end of the program, the narrator, the voiceover, talked about the development of atomic energy and described the making of the first atomic bomb, which was tested in New Mexico in 1945. The narrator said, some scientists thought there was a risk of the atomic bomb explosion igniting the atmosphere and destroying all life on the planet. Has anybody ever heard that story? Something? Okay. But they went ahead with the test anyhow. Was that a wise decision to go ahead with the test? Well, that's a very, very dramatic example of how unwise use of technology could be a serious problem. But there are less dramatic problems having to do with the unwise use of consumer products by the end user. And it comes about when we allow ourselves to be distracted by some kind of attractive device. You know, we all know that if you drive and try to text at the same time, that's dangerous, and people have gotten killed. That's an unwise use of technology. I've seen pedestrians crossing a busy street against the light with traffic coming, and, you know, just feeling the need to look at the phone rather than feeling the need to ensure their safety. See it all the time. You see, you go to a restaurant, you'll see another table, there's a family, and everybody has the phone out. They're not talking to each other. Some years ago, my wife and I took a walk downtown on Main Street in Los Altos to go to the local Starbucks one day, and we saw a couple coming towards us, and they were holding hands. I thought, oh, isn't that a nice gesture of intimacy? That's really nice. Only problem is, the woman had a phone in her left ear, and the man had a phone in his right ear. They were talking to people who knows how far away, holding hands. What happens to the intimacy when you do that, you know? Just the other day, we went back to the same Starbucks, went inside, and they were at a table with two young girls. Junior high. And one of them was on the phone, and the other one was sitting across from her being ignored. You know, it's like the girl on the phone is saying, this is more interesting than you. This is more exciting than you. not in so many words, but the body language is there. Those are examples of unwise use of technology by the end user. Our priority these days in this society is getting attention, being entertained, getting excitement. What's happening is, when we get that, what we lose in getting it is loss of intimacy. We don't talk to each other, we look at the phone. Loss of interest, loss of intimacy. And if you think that is a trivial problem, it's not. Because intimacy is the greatest of human needs. Intimacy is the greatest of human needs. It gives us the feeling that we are connected with each other and with everything. Intimacy includes acknowledgement, affirmation, trust, and love. And losing intimacy or eroding intimacy is just as big a problem as in the material dimension of life. When there is no intimacy, what do we have? When a person feels they are not intimate with others, how do they feel? Isolated. Personal suffering and social problems develop out of that loss of intimacy. So, despite advances in technology in the past 100 years or so, the world is not at peace. The earth is polluted. The oceans are polluted. Species are threatened. Stress is now a way of life, and peace of mind is elusive. That's a long list. That's a very depressing list. But we can't say stop technology, stop progress. Can't do that. So what do we have to do to balance this progress that is not solving those problems of pollution and stress, maybe even creating them? What do we do? Technology needs a partner. Technology needs a partner in order to provide the world what it really needs. In other words, we need the wisdom of our spiritual dimension. The dimension of no ego, the dimension of no BS, the dimension of no delusion, the dimension of caring, our spiritual dimension, is needed to partner with technology. And mindfulness practice is the starting point. Meditation is the starting point. And by itself, it can bring us benefit. It can be used as a technique to quiet a busy, anxious mind, and that's how people are using it these days. Meditation can provide us with some emotional help, can reduce our stress, and reduce our physical pain. But it is important to evolve our use of mindfulness so that it becomes continuous and committed practice, not just a commodity that we pick up during the day when it's convenient or when we feel a little bit stressed. If we use our meditation practice as a technique or a commodity, it will be of little value. We need to evolve our use of it into a continuous committed practice, and that's why we are here. Learning how to take that mind into everything we do. So meditation is more than a technique that is subject to convenience. And our meditation practice is beyond any kind of idea of usefulness or what will I get out of it. Beyond that. So we need to express our inherent wisdom and not be constrained by ego and stubbornness. And this is just as important, more important than material progress. The developed societies like the U.S., material progress is still the highest priority. And we are now just beginning to recognize that it's our spiritual progress that's just as important. We are beginning to awaken to it. That's why we now have such things as Zen centers. It's a reflection of people's recognition that there's another dimension that we need to cultivate. So I concluded the talk down at Singularity by telling them that all of the students there are committed to solving major problems with humanity, just like Buddha did, committed himself. Problems including the climate, the environment, poverty, homelessness, big problems, huge responsibility. They've signed up in their mind to go work on that. Huge responsibility. And what I told them was that I knew that they were bringing passion to their work because you could feel it in the room. And I simply asked them to bring their wide mind and their wisdom as well as their technical expertise. So that was what I spoke at the Singularity University. Does anyone have a question? Yes, please. Yes.
You've seen different ways of technology, so TV, computers, and now smartphones. I'm curious, do you think that technology is more pervasive in our lives now and is a bigger deal now than you've seen in the past? Or is it all just kind of relative to everything that's going on?
In many ways, our lives are better because of technology. But we fall into the trap of letting the technology overwhelm us. You know, television isn't all bad. There's some good programs on television that are educational and entertaining, and we come away from some of these programs a better person. But if we get caught up in it, we can sit in front of that television set all day long. So we have to find a balance with the technologies that come our way. You know, if artificial intelligence is going to make our computers and our machines be able to replace us to do functions, and we start to rely on them to turn on the lights, remind us of appointments, wash the dishes, if we rely on machines to do that, we lose the skill of doing it, and we lose the benefit of having that experience, and we wind up being slave to our machines. So we have to be careful with how we implement technology in our lives. But technology does make for better lives. The advances in medicine is just one example. The advances in transportation is one example. Thank you. Yes, please.
This is not a actually new topic that you know many multiple people in like literature, popular movies, countless number of movies, music, you know, like Stanley Kubrick. Actually, for example, some of the movies, Dr. Strangelove, whatever, Brave New World.
Yes.
These are not new concerns. Personally, I have like multiple technical, different, completely different chemical engineering and computer science and
yes.
work in multiple domains.
Yes.
I do remember having kind of talked about it sometime in the past. A lot of the technical education, and I tend to speak with a broad brush, but at least like from my experience, tended to be really nobody asked the question why. Everybody just basically did how. Basically just trained monkeys to pick up a hammer and use the hammer, but nobody asking should you even pick up the hammer. I mean, I see that all around actually, especially that, you know, when we have so much water and electricity being used for utterly senseless use cases.
Yes, you know. Yes.
So I don't know, even if we solve the problem of, like, you know, because energy problem is a very big problem, but even if we had, like, a way of efficient energy, I don't know, that might lead to, like, you know, just because solving the problem at that level. So I think what you're saying is really the it's not just a pure physical level, but if we don't ask, you know, tie it with the consciousness and, you know, on a spiritual level, as far as what problems are we solving. And so this is not a new thing, it's a cycle, as far as I can see. I don't really have any answers. It's just observation.
Yes, you're right. And the problem is the technologies are getting more and more powerful. So if we make a mistake with a technology, it could be a big mistake. There was a time when the technology wasn't so powerful, and if we made a mistake, that was okay. But now we have automobiles that we can drive over 100 miles an hour. You can make a big problem with that. In the middle of the last century, you didn't have a car that could do that. And 100 years ago, you didn't have a car. You had a horse. You couldn't go very fast. So the more powerful the technology, the more risk we have. And that's why we have to be more mindful when we use it. We should ask why, like you say. We should ask why before we go ahead with something and say, is this really the right thing to do? Well, thank you. Ken first.
So, a follow-on to that comment, we all vote for what technology may, what technology survive and which ones don't. We do that in the market space. We buy it. And so, in some ways, not just capitalism, but it's the marketplace that makes certain things succeed and other things not succeed. And yet, we look at the monastic life where you're foregoing material world. So how do you see, if we're going to have a coming together of this, how do you see that work?
I think it will work when we can go back to appreciating the natural world, when we become more in touch with nature. And not be distracted from paying attention to the birds and the clouds and the flowers and the beauty of the world that we live in, not becoming distracted by that because of this very shiny, entertaining gadget over here, or game, or app, or, you know, you name it. The more those things take over our lives, the less appreciation we have for that beetle. And it becomes harder and harder to fall in love with the blue jay if your mind is turning towards your technology device. But I think that's happening now, starting to happen. People are becoming aware that there is another dimension. And I don't know how it's going to work out, but some people are becoming aware.
So would you say maybe there's always been certain people that are in contact with the spiritual side, but you went through a number of incidents which you've all seen, the texting, the walking down the street, the texting in the car, the variety of things they do to keep out of present time or keep their mind focused on one thing and on the broad spectrum. It's a really hopeful that you've erased that. We're all going to get that. I wonder, with the technology, we go away from that being in present time. We go to having our attention spread elsewhere. Not to be negative, but I observe this going on. Yet there's a number of people in this room that have come here for some reason. We say no gaining idea, but they came here for some reason, whether they are conscious of it or whether there's something innate that draws them there to say, there's something different here that I'm not seeing in my cell phone, or I'm not seeing on the screen, or I'm not whatever. I'm not sure, but human race has always been like, I don't know. That's my question.
Well, it all depends upon how many people become concerned. Thank you. Yes, please.
It seems to me that access to technology is not uniform. There's this digital divide where the first world or small segment of the world population has access to enormous technology. It gives them godlike powers. They're working on immortality projects and that type of thing. Whereas other people have no little or no access to technology. And my concern, question is like, can this create some sort of bifurcated humanity where we have a splitting of, you know, superhumans and like a permanent slave class or underclass will be dominated by, and that seems like a big danger, and how can that be avoided?
Some people, really smart people, scientists and business people, are concerned about the advancement of artificial intelligence because they feel it will lead to exactly that problem. A few people will understand the technology and can use it. Everybody else will have lost their jobs and they won't know what's going on. So then what happens? And, there's a number of articles and papers that have been written about that. So there's a real back and forth going on, addressing your very concerns. We don't know how it's going to be. Yes.
The concern I have with artificial intelligence and automation due to technology is, what if I don't want to be intelligent? I just want to be. What is the definition of intelligent? what's wrong in being less intelligent or less knowledgeable, some people more knowledgeable, without too much of technology, and what's wrong with not going into too much automation, because I see a concern where there is loss of human factors. For example, you can buy a ticket at a train station. When I was young, I used to go, and there was a human relationship that was a bond. Like, I used to go every day and buy a ticket, so there was face to face. So too much automation is taking the human factors away, and what you're talking is intimacy. That's our need, human need, right? How, so if the technology advances so much, there is no off switch to it, unfortunately. You can't turn off your cell phone and say, I'm not going to use cell phone because I don't like technology. It's become the need now. So I understand the intimacy is the need of human beings, but if too much automation is there, human factors are lost, how can we achieve that intimacy?
You have to want it so bad that you don't let the machine overwhelm you. It's your own determination that will maintain the technology. That when you have a chance to meet with somebody in person, you do it rather than send them a text. You don't go for the convenience of the technology. You say, I want to share my heart with this person, so I have to go see her in person. If you don't feel that need to make a connection, then you just sit down and send her a text. So it's up to each of us to want that intimacy and to feel sad when we start to lose it. That's my feeling about it.
What is intelligence? They keep artificial intelligence so much important. We're talking about, with artificial intelligence.
Well,
it's going to be better.
I think, I think the internet could answer the questions better than I can. Thank you. Yes, Lee.
I wanted to say that I'm glad that you had a good reception from this particular audience who is there, because I, like Chandu, feel that so often the most advanced and progressive sciences have these ideas that, without saying, yes, but why? I was driving last week and heard an interview with a physicist who was talking about, oh yes, there's a big thing in physics now that we want to try to make a baby universe in the lab. And I'm thinking to myself, why would you want to make a baby universe? What if that baby universe expanded and blew out your universe? You don't know what's going to happen.
Yes.
Why are you even asking these questions when there's so much that's, closer in to humanity that really needs to be addressed by our science and our technology? So it's heartwarming that some of these people at this Singularity University were really impressed by this, by this idea that yes, there has to be humanity in science. It is not something that you can just do, it's not fooling around anymore. The technology has just advanced too far. So yeah. You have to have a responsibility to what you put your intention on.
Thank you.
Share.
Okay, thank you. More.
Les, I remember last year you had told me about this movie called Lunchbox.
Oh, yeah.
So the whole communication takes place with letters going back and forth underneath a lunchbox. And they're talking to each other, these two people who have never met each other. And on the train in India, and even in the woman's life, all you see is people are busy with screens. And she's not listening to screens. She's talking to this old person now who lives upstairs. And it's like this vocal conversation is going on. and listening to music and writing a letter, and it was just like this whole slowing down idea of how slowing down of this can give you this idea that there is something more than what can be provided by screens or getting lost in a fast life. Just they're talking about TVs and how the TV is not big enough, and they have to get a bigger TV and they have to get a bigger newer cell phone. And she's sitting there, she writes a letter every day, sends out this food to this person who she's never met, and she gets a letter back. And it was just amazing that, you know, culture that is growing technologically so fast and is catching up, even in that culture there is a slight rift there that says, slow down.
Okay. All of your questions and your concerns are really important. We've just now begun to investigate all this. So we just have to keep going forward and keep thinking about it and see what develops. Our speaker next week will be a woman from Singularity University, a woman who created the classes that they're going through. So she is not a professed Buddhist or a Zen practitioner or anything like that. But when you talk to her, you meet her and talk to her and understand what she's doing, you know, she's a Buddhist. Even though... So Ellie will be here next week as a guest speaker. So you can ask these questions of her. And, you know, hopefully, if you like, hopefully we can... in the coming months and years, start a dialogue with those people. Maybe we could do that. What do you think? I know Teresa is very interested in that. So maybe we can make some personal connections with people and enrich our practice that way. Okay.
Stop.